Your eyes and your vision are under attack, damaging blue light from the sun. Your phone, your computer, your tablet, even light bulbs and car headlights is constantly bombarding you. The good news is our eyes actually already have a line of defense to counter the effects of blue light. This defense is made up of three pigments called carotenoids. MacuHealth with Micromycel, the only supplement with the exclusive patent on all three macular carotenoids and Micromycel technology.
Do your patients know what presbyopia is?
There are people who are afraid of the press.
Have you talked to your patients about multifocal contact lenses?
I've heard the bifocal, but not
right,
multifocal.
Exactly.
Do you need help with your multifocal strategy? Learn more at the conclusion of this episode. With more screen usage and indoor time, myopia, also known as nearsightedness, is increasing and getting worse in children. Now, certified eye doctors can prescribe MySight One Day, the first and only FDA-approved soft contact lens to slow myopia progression in age-appropriate children. Visit CooperVision.com to find a Brilliant Futures certified eye doctor near you. Good morning, I'm Dr. Kerry Gelb, and welcome to Open Your Eyes Radio. Please listen as I discuss the newest information in the world of health, nutrition, and sports every Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Central Time on AM 1280 of The Patriot. Please share your thoughts by emailing me at drkerrygelb@gmail.com. That's drkerrygelb@gmail.com. And visit my website, drkerrygelb.com. We're back with Ken Cavazzoni, the author of Immortal, and you could buy this book at all the major book retailers. And we're mixing baseball, we're mixing politics. He played professional baseball, he coached, and he's going to give us some insights to what it's like to be coaching at such a high level, to be evaluating at such a high level baseball players. And Ken, thanks again for joining me again this week. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. It's great to be here.
You know, I really enjoyed our conversation last week, and we talked a little bit off the air. You actually, the Twins, you know, they won their first playoff series. They have this great young player, Royce Lewis, who unfortunately has some injuries, had two home runs in the first game. We had him on our fantasy team. The kid is going to be a monster. He really is going to be a monster. But you coach one of the players on the Twins. Tell us a little bit about that, and were you able to tell he was different than everybody else, that he was going to make it, or he surprised you by making it?
Yeah, I coached in an organization called Baseball U, and Alex Kirilloff was involved with Baseball U. He played in tournaments and was part of the program. And he was an outstanding player then. I mean, by the time I saw him or got to understand what he was about, it was already rumored that he was going to be a top-round draft pick. So he did go in the first round. I think he had a scholarship to go to Liberty, of all places, believe it or not, and ended up signing out of high school. You know, those types of players, they stick out right away. He's a tremendous hitter, great stroke. You see that right away. But it's fun to see somebody like that, somebody that you've had a brief interaction with, make it not only to the big leagues, but on the big scene. There's a gentleman that endorsed my book. His name is Kevin Jarvis. He pitched 12 years in the big leagues. His son in late August got called up to the Arizona Diamondbacks and was put on the Arizona Diamondbacks roster. So he's pitching in the playoffs as well. So it's fun. You get those interactions and it really makes it enjoyable.
When you played single A in the Cincinnati Reds organization, did you play with anybody that made it to the big leagues?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was drafted in 1991, and the first round pick was Pokey Reese, Calvin Reese. So I played with Pokey for a couple of years. So he had a nice career. I always say my claim to fame was that, you know, in where were we? Playing at Burlington against the Indians for the Cincinnati Reds minor league affiliate. I was batting third and playing left field. And for the Indians affiliate, it was Manny Ramirez playing center field. Now, a little different because I was drafted out of college and he was drafted out of high school. So there's a little age difference there, but that's my brush up with one of the greats.
And when you played against Manny, how did he do that game?
I kid you not, we played a series against them, and just as my manager was saying, this kid hasn't done anything. He's supposed to be the real deal. He hasn't done anything. Boom, 450 feet shot to center field. I mean, the talent was there.
You know, it must be great to see players like that and playing with Pokey Reese. What was he like as a young player?
Pokey Reese was tremendously athletic. I think he could have played football at Arizona State as a quarterback. You gotta remember, he was drafted out of high school as well. So he was skinny. He was small. You know, your first glance at him, you're like, this kid's the number one draft pick. But man, he was a great athlete, had a cannon for an arm, could run really well. Still maintain a little bit of contact with him through social media. Just a really good guy too.
Wow, that's great. So as time went on and, you know, you got injured and, you know, you had to end your baseball career, what was that like to have to end your career as a player?
For me, again, it was a realization that, you know, do you want to spend more time going after this dream, or do you want to be realistic? And I think I gave you a professional at bat, but there was players there that were just much more athletic than I ever was. So I would evaluate, you know, players that were really tremendously athletic that I thought weren't great baseball players, and I would just simply ask the question, even though I think I'm a better hitter, maybe, who would you rather have on your team? And it was the other guy, because, and I wasn't slow, but I wasn't somebody that could run real well. I could hit a little bit. I wasn't great in the field, but you know, the athletes are the athletes, and I didn't think I'd ever get to that spot. So it wasn't that hard to step away, and I continued to play after the fact on an amateur basis. So it is what it is. You know, I look back at it, and I had a good time doing it.
You know, today it seems like a lot of the kids after a certain age, they're just going to concentrate on one sport. When we were kids, we would play multiple sports. What do you think of the kids just concentrating and predominantly playing one sport versus playing multiple sports?
I think physically that hurts them, playing one sport. I think it benefits tremendously if you play different seasons and you're getting different muscles involved. I played basketball in high school as well as baseball. I think that helped. You know, you're two different muscle sets that you're not straining over time. It has become that way though. You know, the to be competitive, a lot of players just go to one way and that's it. And you know, I don't like it overall, but it's the trend, and that's I don't think it's going anywhere, Gary. I think it's here to stay.
And as a coach, you know, there's always parents that think their kid should play more than they do, or they think their kid is overlooked. How did you handle that as a coach with parents who thought their kid should play more than they did?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, everybody's a shortstop until you have to tap them on the shoulder and say, your kid's not a shortstop. I don't know how many times I've had to have that conversation. And some take it well, some don't. You know, the problem we have now is, you know, there's this whole travel baseball structure that there's so many teams that, and it really hurts the player in the long run. It really hurts the athlete in the long run. They decide to go elsewhere. No, they're not happy. They're not playing shortstop. They're not batting leadoff. They're not doing this. They take their stuff and go somewhere else where somebody promises them that. I just coached. I always tried to be honest with people and just like, this is what I see. You know, what's your goal? If your goal is to be a high school player, this is what you should do. If your goal is to be a college player, this is what you should do. Some take it well, some don't.
Right. I mean, you know, it's a difficult situation being a coach. I mean, I was a coach with little kids, not at the level you were, but, you know, it's tough, you know, because we could see things very differently than the parents see. And sometimes coaches make mistakes. Michael Jordan was cut from his team. And I think Alex Rodriguez got cut from his high school team, his freshman year or something. So sometimes, you know, coaches do make mistakes.
They absolutely do. And it's our job to give an opinion, you know, explain to players what they need to work on and take it from there. It's never going to be an equation that's infallible. So you just do what you do and you see what you see and you make recommendations upon that.
And what were some of the valuable lessons that you've learned first as a player and then as a coach and an evaluator?
Oh, where can I start?
let's start as a player. We're coming up to the break anyway. We have about a minute left in this segment, but let's start as a player, some of the lessons that you've learned.
Well, I mean, baseball, it just lends itself to perseverance, right? You know, you're never going to be great all the time, so you have to persevere. Hard work gets you where you need to be. You're never as good as you think you are. That's another thing. And you're never as bad as you think you are. You know, so you just got to kind of have an even mindset. Being on that even keel is a lesson that every player should learn.
You know, for those that are watching now, there's a baseball player, a pitcher, who has turned out that he was falsely accused and he had to go pitch in Japan, Trevor Bauer. Can you talk about how easy it is for a professional athlete, a famous person, to be taken advantage of, because it's come out that he was taken advantage of. And I think he could have been very angry, and he's actually handled it pretty well.
Yeah, very interesting situation there. And when the story came out a couple of days ago and I watched what he put out, what's really crazy about the whole situation is I just completed my second novel. I'm just starting to circulate it a little bit. Now, it's not published yet, so I'm just starting to circulate it. And it, in an essence, is the Trevor Bauer story. It's about a baseball player who gets set up by somebody and extorts him. I think it happens more often than one might think. And I remember when the Trevor Bauer stuff happened initially. What happened? The Dodgers got rid of him immediately. He was banished by the major leagues. I think in his situation, maybe he had enough money that he decided to fight it. And now he can come up with a story. And who knows what happens from here. I think it's going to be interesting to see if there's any lawsuits that derive, because everybody rushed a judgment on him. They said what a bad guy he is, and this must be true. And the stuff that he put out was just incredible. So this next book is called The Meal Ticket. And I wrote it 20 years ago and decided to revamp it and modernize it and now go to publication with it at some point. And it literally is about that type of thing that happens to athletes. I wrote it 20 years ago off of somebody that I knew, a baseball player that I knew that got extorted. So that happened 20 years ago as well. For Trevor Bauer, I hope something good comes out of this. I hope that people don't rush to judgment when this happens all the time. Whether it's, you know, it happened with the Duke lacrosse players, sometimes there's another side to things, and that's got to be considered as well.
You know, I think that's one of the issues with our country, and you mix your book with politics, is we do rush to judgment and we don't hear the other side a lot of times, and we cancel people, and we're suspending free speech. We're only hearing one side, and I'm not sure why this has happened and why it's happening, but it is happening.
It happens a lot. And I think that's part of why I started really getting into writing fiction again. And it allows me a way to do this social commentary and to make these points. I don't know why it happens. I think everything just becomes so based on what titillates, and nobody wants facts anymore. And so much stuff is hidden, and some of stuff is just negated. And if you are not on one side or not doing things that the regime wants you to think, you're discounted. So that's kind of it's partially why I started doing these things and writing these books and trying to make something that's entertaining, but also thoughtful.
You know, and we talked about last week a little bit about patriotism, loving for your country. And it seems that the powers that be want to take religion away and want to take the love for our country away. And you, as a writer, as an author, I know you've thought a lot about this and how you've added it into your book. Why do you think that's happening? You know, we know it's happening, but the why is what people don't understand.
I think there's little doubt that it's orchestrated. I think there's little doubt that this is just an effort to break down our society. To me, it's crystal clear. I wrote a blog, I don't know, maybe a month ago, Reasons for Optimism, because I started noticing things that I think it's finally turning, Gary. I really do. You know, when they tried to cancel Jason Aldean for writing, tried out in a small town and it went to number one, or what was the name? Oliver Anthony there, singing his song and it goes to the top of the charts, or even things that happened with Budweiser. And, you know, there's another side here. And I think we've come to a toleration point. And I think there's signs out there that this isn't going to be tolerated any longer. I really do. And I'm optimistic about that.
You think because of the way the politicians, there's no term limits, and the politicians just stay there forever and ever and seem to be controlled. And then they control the police force and they control the military. Is there a way that we can be optimistic, or since they control the military, they control the police, they'll arrest an old lady for not wearing a mask in a park. Is there hope for us? Is there hope for our society? Is there hope for our country?
Yeah, I think there is. I think it has to come with just a groundswell. You know, the more people that get involved, the more. And Immortal has that underlying theme, too. I wrote that considering apathy, right? You're doing your thing. I'm doing my thing. We notice things that are wrong in our country. We notice things. We might have commentary on it. We might even speak about it, write about it a little bit. But how many of us just don't act on anything, right? You know, we're too busy living our own lives. And I think the powers that are against us kind of take that and use that against us, right? They know that, you know, we're a prosperous nation and we're a nation of people that are living their lives and it's pretty comfortably. So they kind of infiltrate the things that are in society that they want to change with very little resistance. And I think even though we're apathetic to some point, I do think that changes. I do think there's a point in time where we just say enough is enough. And I do think there's examples of that. Electing the right people is going to be helpful. but I think it also just has to do with what happens in each community. And I think there's enough is enough. And you see that in, you know, school board meetings. You see how intense those have gotten. It's coming. I think there is something to be optimistic about.
And do you think we can get fair elections?
I hope so. I hope so. I mean, if not, we're in big trouble. Boy, that's a different path. I don't even know if we want to go down that one. But so much of that is clear to me as well. And you know, how are we going to get fair elections? Well, people have to be fed up with that as well, you know, because you can see what has happened in certain instances, and you know, enough's enough. You can't be apathetic about it. Enough's enough.
And can you arrest your political opponents and make people afraid to speak out?
They're trying, right? They're certainly trying. You know, that's a tactic and a technique. I honestly think that something happened. I can't exactly pin when. Okay, when you know, they talk about the Uniparty, right? That it's all one big mess. And if you look at the way our representatives are now, it's almost like the majority of them are so self-serving that they made a deal with amongst each other that they're going to get rich and they're going to allow a lot of things to just go. I can't pin exactly when it was. I do think it, you know, I want to say it traces back to Pelosi when she took power and started influencing people. But you have it on both sides. And that's the troubling part. When you have it on both sides and there's no checks and balances, well, yeah, then we can have some trouble. But I think we're finally being aware of it now. I think it's going to change.
You know, I do see it as a uniparty, and this is what happens when there's no term limits. Yeah. Because people could be influenced, whether they're paid off, they're bribed, they're who knows what, you know, why this is happening. Maybe there's a few good ones, but without term limits the way it was supposed to be, how can, you know, it's easy to get these politicians and influence them to be self-serving and not serve the public.
Oh, come on. What are you trying to say? Bob Menendez didn't just take a little bit out of his bank account every couple of weeks? It's amazing. And like I said, I can't pin it down, but there was a point, and it always happened, but I think there was a deal saying, look, we're all going to get rich. Just keep your mouth shut. Because it seems to happen on both sides. It really does. And politicians get into office and all of a sudden their net worth goes up significantly. And that never was supposed to happen. Our founders didn't intend it that way. That's for sure.
You know, I've heard one of the commentators on the radio say the left lights the house on fire and the right blocks the fire trucks. And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, there is. And it wasn't always like that. You know, it definitely wasn't always like that. There was caution before doing something stupid. Right? There was caution before doing something self-serving, because the other side would rat you out. Well, now they don't. Now they look the other way, and that happens on both sides.
You know, they used to. It seemed like they used to be for the people, and now, like you said, there's a self-serving aspect to it that is really very uncomfortable for the average Joe trying to feed his family through this inflation. We're up against the break. This is Dr. Kerry Gelb for Open Your Eyes Radio. I'm talking with Ken Cavazzoni. His book, Immortal, pick up his book, A Mixture of Politics and Baseball. My two favorite subjects. I'm so happy to have Ken here. We'll be back after the break.
MacuHealth, your science-born and tested solutions for visual performance, macular degeneration, and dry eye syndrome. New products coming soon. Embrace the science.
We're back with Ken Cavazzoni, the author of Immortal. You could go to his website at kencavazzoni.com. That's C-A-V-A-Z-Z-O-N-I. Pick up his book. You're going to love his book. You might shed a few tears toward the end of his book, but it really is a fantastic book, and I really loved it. And I know you will also. This is Dr. Kerry Gelb for Open Your Eyes Radio on AM 1280 The Patriot. I'm back with Ken. We were talking a little bit of politics, but we're going to bring it back to baseball. And he has a quote in his book from Ben Franklin, and I want him to comment on and why he put it in his book. And Ben Franklin said, we are all born ignorant, but one must work hard to remain stupid. Can you tell me why you put that in your book and what that meaning has to that? Because I just love that quote.
Well, that was, I don't want to give too much away of the context of it, but if you think about the way we veer sometimes in our thinking, and particularly in, as it related to that particular scene, you know, we seem to have, as a society, certain opinions that veer against logic. So you almost have to intentionally be stupid to actually accept some of the stuff that goes on. The one thing that, you know, kind of playing off of that is baseball doesn't get enough credit for the formation of some of the thoughts that we should be thinking about instead of remaining stupid and ignorant, right? If you think about how Jackie Robinson came into play and how baseball itself actually was a leader in the civil rights movement, take a step back and think now about professional athletes who don't even look at that, right? They don't even look at the greatness. And to me, that was almost by design. It was almost divine intervention, right? It seems so incredible that a sport would be a leader in that aspect and lead a movement like that. So that Ben Franklin quote was not exactly about the civil rights movement, but it was about how people demonstrate their ignorance towards certain topics, including that fight and that idea that divides us in our country, right? There's an idea that people don't get along and there's race issues in our society. And, you know, you have to believe a lot of things to not just realize that, you know, we're all one here. And it used to be that way.
You know, I think in baseball, you know, it's an example of being one, because you have the best guys are going to play in Major League Baseball. It doesn't matter if you're from Japan or you're from the Dominican Republic or you're from the United States. The best players are going to play. And that's what people love about baseball. And baseball means so much to people. You know, it just means so much to people, you know, to be able to go out and have a catch and the smell of the grass, even if the field is horrible. We talked about that in the first segment. It just means so much. And I think about, why does it mean so much to us? It just, it's crazy.
There's a purity to it, right? And like you said, you can just have a ball and a glove and have a catch. It's the only game that, you know, the defense has the ball. It's different, right? It's something that makes our minds work. And there's such a tradition to it. And there's so many things as far as records go. And you talk about immortals, you know, Jackie Robinson to me is an immortal, right? He was a great baseball player, but it was something else. Ted Williams to me is an immortal because he was different. He was something else. So I think that texture leads itself to our appreciation of the game and why it means so much to us.
You know, we bring up Immortal in the name of your book. Why did you name it Immortal? And talk to us about some of the immortals throughout history.
I just started thinking about, you know, what's the difference? What makes somebody immortal? I mean, there's obviously people in our history that we just look back upon and instantly we have recognition of what they were and what they did and the relevance to our society. So what makes you immortal? Well, it's not just your prowess on the field. It's something else that you did or something else that you contributed. So, you know, you mentioned previously, you know, somebody like John Wayne. So it doesn't have to be an athlete. Rush Limbaugh isn't an immortal to me, without question, what he contributed to society. There's so many people that you can look upon from the past that just conjure an instant image. And why is that? Well, it has to do with what they've left us, not what they did, but what they've left us. And that ability to lean on that tradition, that history, is really what moves us forward as a society, really does.
You know, in the book, one of my favorite characters is Ethan. If you could talk a little bit about that without giving away too much, because I want people to read the book.
Yeah, Ethan's a kid, right? Ethan's a kid and a baseball fan who's got his own issues, and he ends up relying upon the main character, T.C. Hunter, as a critical part of his being able to deal with the issues that he's gone through as a young child. You look at that as, you know, something that who did I look up to when I was a kid, you know, and that relationship there, it doesn't have to be father and son, but I think it exists in baseball. It exists in other sports as well. But that, you know, who was it? Mookie Betts having a catch with a kid in the outfield, you know, something like that. When somebody that is in that position can lend a hand to a young kid and just make that kid feel special, it carries forward more than we can ever know. So that's why I wanted to have a character like Ethan, somebody that can grow with a great baseball player, and T.C. Hunter is the best player in the world, really. But there's ability for T.C. Hunter to contribute more than just as a baseball player.
And do you know any baseball players, I mean, you're close to the game, that had relationships with fans like an Ethan that you might be able to tell us about?
You see it happen all the time. Off the top of my head, I'm losing the name.
While you think of that for a minute, yeah. Let me interrupt you for a second. A good friend of mine who actually is one of the producers of, he's the producer of the podcast. And we have the podcast and we have the radio show. And the podcast is where, you know, it's on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And then we have the radio show. And he did interviews and he wrote articles. And he told me a story about Deion Sanders. And he was interviewing Deion Sanders for a piece. And he went up to Deion Sanders in the locker room. And Deion Sanders was actually answering every single letter that he got from a fan. And, you know, Wayne, who's the producer, that meant so much to Wayne to see a professional athlete do something like that. And you know, I'm not sure how unusual it is because I don't know professional athletes, but I was wondering if there's anything like that you might be able to point out, because things like that just make you feel good.
They do. And it happens behind the scenes more often than you think. I mean, when I was a minor league ball player, one of the things we did normally was go to hospitals and go to the pediatric wards and just to see those kids. They didn't know who we were, but they knew we were something, and we were introduced as ball players, and it changes an entire day. You know, it changes a kid's outlook for an entire day. I always appreciate the ball player that does things that, you know, doesn't get credit for it. And it happens often. They contribute to society in different ways. I go back to talking about Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh's, you know, maligned by so many people, but there's so many things that he did, and he never talked about it. And only after his passing did things come out of how much he's helped people financially, emotionally. I mean, you know, it's the stuff that goes on behind the scenes that really makes a man.
You know, in the book, one of the main characters is Chief Virgil Daly, and he was almost like a father figure to T.C. Hunter. And where did that come from? Did that come from any personal experience, Chief Daly, where you came up with that character?
The image of Chief Daly was easy to me, because it was always that older guy that was the clubby around the locker room and around the ballpark. Sometimes it was a guy that you didn't even know you should talk to. He kind of looked a little even crazy. But when you got to know him, you figure out that he has a legacy of himself and was a ball player himself. That was a fun character for me. That was really fun to conjure. I have an image of what Chief looks like, right? I have an image of, he's probably an amalgamation of a lot of people that I ran into. And again, it was the clubby. It was the guy in college that used to hand out the uniforms. It was, you know, the guy in the minor leagues who used to, you know, rake the fields. It was a combination of all those people. And how I became a father figure is kind of cool. And just, that's kind of a natural to the story.
Yeah, I mean, he really stood out as a real hero without being a hero in the book. And I just love for what he stood for: honor, hard work, decency, and his relationship with T.C. Hunter was really special. And I really enjoyed that part of the book.
Well, I appreciate that. And he did all his work behind the scenes, right? He wasn't looking for credit.
So Ken, we talked at the break that now you give hitting lessons. So tell us about hitting and how we could help kids become better hitters.
That's one of the things that I do now that I really, really enjoy. I enjoy working with young hitters. Veering back to Ted Williams, you know, when I was growing up and a hitter myself, you know, there was a book, The Science of Hitting. And Ted Williams wrote that book and it became my Bible. So I always revert back to those thoughts of how Ted Williams himself taught me a lot, because we didn't have any instructors back then. Nowadays, you know, a lot of young players have their own personal hitting instructor, and I've been fortunate enough to work with a lot of young kids. The best part for me is when a young kid progresses through and follows the path and ends up becoming a, you know, maybe a college player or a pro player. It's a lot of fun. It's a way for me to give back. You know, I have my own theories on hitting. There's a lot of different things that are out there. I try to combat some of the things that I don't like and try to encourage the things that I do. I'm not a hitting absolutist. So there's a lot of, you turn on a baseball game, there's 18 different hitters. They're all doing something slightly different. So I'm never one to coach and say, you got to hit like me, but there's certain principles involved. And I do like studying that and trying to help kids figure that part out.
What do you think is the major mistake the kids, most kids do the same thing, the same mistake that you can improve on?
Right now, I don't like what the concentration is on the game, right? It's about analytics and how hard you're hitting a ball and hitting the ball in the air. Now, when I was a player, it wasn't about hitting the ball in the air. You wanted to hit it hard and on the ground. Now it's the opposite, theory-wise, but I don't buy into that opposite because, you know, for every Aaron Judge out there, there's got to be a, you know, an Arise who knows how to get base hits. So I don't think about launch angles. I don't talk about launch angles. I don't talk about, you know, exit velocity. I talk about barreling baseballs. You know, can you barrel a baseball? Can you get the rhythm, get the breath through at the proper trajectory and hit the ball in a barrel? And if you can do that, you can be a successful player. So that's my concentration.
I notice a lot of players don't use their wrists anymore. You know, they swing and there's no wrist involved. What do you think about not using your wrists and swinging a baseball bat?
Yeah, well, that kind of goes back to that analytics thing and launch angle. And, you know, Henry Aaron was known as a wrist hitter, right? He supposedly had the strongest wrist and you know, he was pretty successful, I think, right? So now they forget about that. Now they're trying to get a bat path that is a little bit different. And, you know, I don't think it works for a lot of players. Might work for some, but not a lot.
You know, and I think depending on the strength of a person, you know, you could be a great hitter, but not be as strong as an Aaron Judge, like a Luis Arise. And you got to hit within yourself. And you got to be the type, you got to know what kind of hitter you are.
Precisely, right? There's more than one way to hit. And that's why my hero was Don Mattingly. He can do a little bit of everything. He would use his wrists a little bit, right? He would take the pitch on the outside half and fling it into left field. But then he'd get the pitch on the inside half and put it in the right field seats. Now, those are the types of players that I like. Those are the types of hitters that I like. Guys that can do a little bit of everything. And again, the way the game is concentrated on, you know, analytical stats and, you know, there's a whole theory behind that with the Yankees of why they're having their troubles. And I kind of lend hand to that because that's not what you do. That's not how to concentrate on the game. That's not how to concentrate on hitters. And, you know, Acuna, you know, he's not really worried about launch angle. I can tell you that right now. He's just a good hitter, right? So the game veers in certain ways, and I think it also self-corrects.
You know, he sees it and hits it. And I don't think he's much more than that.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to me that he has a traditional new swing. He just sees the ball and crushes it.
Yeah, don't go try talking launch angle to Miguel Cabrera. He'll laugh at you. You know, just great, great hitters are great for a reason. And some of the stuff they're emphasizing now just doesn't play with me.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit, you know, it's kind of serendipitous the way we met. A friend introduced us and told me about your book, and then you had a little eye issue. Maybe we could help some other people with that and tell us what happened.
Sure. I was minding my own business, Kerry, and I was sitting on the couch watching college football. It was nighttime and the room was dark, and all of a sudden I started seeing flashing out of my periphery. And I thought I was having an electric problem with my kitchen. I thought something was going on. So I got myself up and I made sure I wasn't having a seizure and then kind of blew it off for a couple of days and didn't re-experience that. But then I started having some floating things in my left eye. Got myself finally to see a doctor about it. And they thought it was a slight tear in my retina. And that slight tear turned into, well, no, it's not a slight tear. It's a detached retina. So I had to have major surgery. I have certainly a tremendous appreciation now for ophthalmology. I wouldn't wish the experience on anybody, but at the same time, it was something I could look back on and, wow, what great care I got. Doctors were fantastic. And know, just the technology and the advancements are just incredible.
Well, I'm glad you called me about it.
Yeah, no, you're great. You helped me a lot, and you know, it was kind of thrown at me. I went from, okay, I got a little bit of an eye issue, to you have to have emergency surgery, and you were very helpful in making sure that I was doing the right thing. And you know, with so much going on in our country, you kind of, you know, you veer off of trusting even doctors these days, and you really helped me know that what I was doing was the right path, and it's worked out.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. So as we finish up, we got about 3.5 minutes left. I do want to ask you about one of the characters in the book, the manager, Billy Lohr. Now, is it Billy after Billy Martin? Is that what we got?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, a little bit there. Yeah, there's a little Billy Martin there, and it's a reference to old school baseball that I think the game is lost a little bit.
And his lore, because he laid down the lore and he used old school baseball, or after the pitcher Vernon Lohr?
I don't think it was after Vernon Lohr, but you know, it's funny when you're writing this, you're just trying to come up with names, and you know, certainly Billy Martin comes to mind, and you're like, well, I can't use Martin, so you kind of think of other things, and you know, it might have touched on laying down the law type of thing, you know, because I tend to do that with my names in my novels.
You know, I like the line you had in the book. I don't know if this is you. If this was from Babe Ruth, but that slumps are like soft beds; they're easy to get into, but hard to get out of.
Yeah, I think that was Johnny Bench. I want to say.
Oh, is that right?
It might have been Bench that said that. Yeah, there's another great one.
Yeah, and. You know, and you had a line in there for the young kids or for parents who are coaching their kids listening to this. Babe Ruth said, never be afraid to strike out. Talk to me about striking out, and what's the mindset about, in the old days, it used to be an embarrassment to strike out. Now, if you strike out, it's the same as grounding out. It's the same as hitting a hard fly ball, being robbed of a double in the outfield.
Yeah, that I don't like. So that's not the intention of the quote. You know, I still think you don't want to strike out, and the modern game has changed that a little bit. There's a lot of things that go on now on social media comparing Tony Gwynn to other players. You know, they'll say like Aaron Judge struck out 180 times or whatever it is, and Tony Gwynn did it and struck out 180 times in 20 years. So I still think there should be a little bit of a negative attached to striking out, but the whole point of the quote is, you know, you got to try, you know, you got to try to swing the bat, and by swinging the bat, that's when you can accomplish some things.
You think so many of the arm injuries now from pitchers is because they throw so hard?
I do. I think it's partially due to training. I honestly think it's under training at some, in some respect. You know, Nolan Ryan didn't have arm troubles. In 1974, he pitched a game where he threw 230 pitches in like 16 innings, something crazy. He didn't have arm troubles. You know, a lot of the old time players didn't have arm troubles. So I think it's a combination of babying and working too hard and too much torque, a little bit of combination of it all.
Well, great conversation with Ken Cavazzoni, kencavazzoni.com. He wrote the novel Immortal. Ken, I want to thank you for joining me today, last week and this week. What a great conversation. If people want to find out more about you, how can they do that?
First of all, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Kerry. Go to my website, kencavazzoni.com. I have blogs on there, too, that I think people will find some entertainment out of. And you can also hit a couple of links and go right to the book from that website as well.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed the conversation. You're a great conversationalist, mixing sports, baseball, and politics. This is Dr. Kerry Gelb for Open Your Eyes Radio on AM 1280 The Patriot. Until next week, thanks for joining me.
Your eyes and your vision are under attack. Damaging blue light from the sun, your phone, your computer, your tablet, even light bulbs and car headlights is constantly bombarding you. The good news is our eyes actually already have a line of defense to counter the effects of blue light. This defense is made up of three pigments called carotenoids. MacuHealth with Micromycel, the only supplement with the exclusive patent on all three macular carotenoids and Micromycel technology.
Fitting multifocal contact lenses presents a big opportunity to meet patient needs while growing your practice. Alcon is your partner not only with our innovative portfolio, but through e-learning. Learn to enhance your multifocal strategy today with the Alcon Experience Academy.
OIE Broadcasting is the emerging leader in social media.
We use scientific entertainment to drive more patients into your office.
Visit OIEBroadcasting.com and sign up today.